With the completion of the book of Nehemiah in previous numbered 24, we came to the end of the historical period of the nation of Israel and Judah. Because when Nehemiah returned the second time from Persia under Artaxerxes, it was in the late 5th century B.C., probably about 430 B.C. or even later. Only Malachi will be around after the time of Nehemiah, or at the earliest during the latter years of Nehemiah. So, generally speaking, the inspired record contained in the Old Testament of the history of Israel and Judah came to an end with the period of Nehemiah-Malachi at about 400 B.C. With this, the period of silence began, which lasted approximately 430 years. It began in 400 B.C. and terminated when the voice of John the Baptist was heard in approximately 30 A.D. The period in between is called the intertestamental period and contains the apocryphal books, among which is the book of Maccabees, which contains the statement, "The voice of the prophet has not been heard in the land." Much as Ezra said, "What more can we say?" God, in turn, could say, "What more can I do?" Everything possible had been done until we see in the latter years of Nehemiah and in the time of Malachi, the people were still rebelling against God and were involved in a formalized, legalistic outward worship system until finally God said, "I have no other response other than total destruction or silence." Because of the Davidic covenant, he could not destroy the nation of Judah, so he simply went away to his place, as Hosea chapter 5 stated earlier. However, before terminating our consideration of the historical books in the Old Testament, we must look at the book of Esther. Even though Esther follows the book of Nehemiah in the English structure, it nevertheless occurred prior to the time of Nehemiah, and it has its inception in the third year of King Xerxes, which was approximately 483 B.C. So historically, the book of Esther occurs about 25 years prior to Ezra's return to Jerusalem, and must be considered in light of our earlier verse, which we examined in Isaiah chapter 48, which said, "Flee Babylon." Looking back historically to the edict of Cyrus in 539, when he allowed anyone who wanted to return to the land of Judah, we must ask ourselves, why didn't all the people return? Isaiah had instructed the people to flee Babylon when Cyrus came in. But we found that Zerubbabel was only able to round up a little under 50,000 to return with him. And then Ezra, a little later following the book of Esther, is only able to put together about 1,700 people to return with him until finally, when they returned with Nehemiah, it was some few men. It can only be assumed that the people who had gone to exile into Babylon had become very comfortable in their situation by the time Cyrus captured the city in 539. Then, in the ensuing years under the Persian monarchs, the people became very comfortable. But I submit to you that it was a comfort couched in disobedience. Disobedience because they had not obeyed the earlier command of God through Isaiah the prophet to return to the land of Judah. Therefore, the book of Esther must be seen as taking place in the land of Persia and involving a large number of Jews who had not followed the command of God and were actually living in disobedience in a land where they could not participate in the religious system as it was designed to occur in the city of Jerusalem, and were under the monarchy of a foreign nation rather than being back in the land of Jerusalem under the priesthood and under God. Therefore, the book of Esther begins and introduces us to King Xerxes, keeping in mind the earlier indications that the Persians had been involved in intense military activity and had recently suffered defeat at the hands of the Greeks at Marathon in 490, and were very shortly to experience defeat by the Greeks at Thermopylae in 480 and Salamis in 479. With these things in mind, we see that Xerxes has sought refuge and escape in banqueting and partying and in his harem. The story picks up in his third year, which may have been about 483 or 482, and his party lasts for 180 days or 6 months. Imagine a party lasting for 6 months. At the end of that time, he gave a special 7-day banquet, and Queen Vashti was evidently very beautiful to behold, and he sent a command to her to come out and to expose herself and her beauty to his drunken friends as they partied and drank according to the law. She refused to come out, and the king became very angry, verse 12 says, and his wrath burned within him. King Xerxes was the kind of man who would not take no for an answer. And he said to the wise men around him, check the law books and see what we can do to this lady, my queen, because she did not obey my command as it was delivered by the eunuchs. It was common for kings in these days to have eunuchs around them. A eunuch is a man that had been castrated, and it was not so much for prevention of sexual activity with the women in the harem as to prevent impregnation by anyone other than the king, so that the king could be assured that every child born in his harem was indeed royal seed. The wise men informed the king that Queen Vashti did not only wrong the king, but all the princes and all the peoples who are in the provinces. Because, number one, the queen's conduct is going to become known. And when the women see that Queen Vashti got away with saying no to King Xerxes, they are all going to have contempt for their husbands, so that when their husbands ask them to do something, they're going to refuse because Queen Vashti refused. And this thing is going to have a domino effect and a snowball effect, which will end up with women's lib. And they knew that this thing could never be. Verse 19, they said, if it pleases the king, then let a royal word go forth, and let it be written in the laws of the Medes and the Persians, so that it cannot be repealed or changed, that Vashti should come no more into the presence of the king, and let the king give her royal position to another. So she is going to be dethroned. The crown will be taken away from her and given to someone who is more worthy. And then, when the king's edict is heard throughout the kingdom, all the women will say, great is the king, and then they'll give honor to their husbands, and we'll not have any kind of women's lib movement in this land. And the word pleased the king and the princes, needless to say. And he sent letters to all of his provinces that every man should be master in his own house. So the search began in chapter 2. The king's overseers went through all the provinces and gathered every beautiful young virgin to the capital in Susa and put them into the harem. I imagine that must have broken the hearts of every young man throughout the kingdom, because the king had first choice on the most beautiful ladies of the land and took them for himself. But there was not much that the young men could do. Then the young lady who pleases the king will become queen in place of Vashti. Verse 4 says, and the matter pleased the king. In verse 5, we're introduced to Mordecai, a Benjamite, and he had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives back in the time of Nebuchadnezzar, verse 6 tells us. He was responsible to care for Esther, his uncle's daughter, because she had neither father nor mother. Of course, this would make Esther the cousin of Mordecai. Mordecai took her as his own daughter. In verse 8, we see that when the command and decree of the king was heard throughout the land, that the young ladies were gathered around, and Esther, who must have been very beautiful, was taken into the palace as well. And the young lady pleased the head man in the harem, and he provided her with the best of cosmetics and food and gave her 7 choice maids. But she did not tell them that she was a Jewess. Verse 10 tells us, Mordecai had instructed her earlier that she should not make this matter known. Mordecai walks back and forth in front of the harem every day to see if he could hear some rumors or some scuttlebutt from inside about how things were proceeding. Verse 12 says that when the turn of each lady came to go in after the end of her 12 months, imagine, they would spend 12 months in preparing the young ladies before they could go in to spend the night with the king. They would take 6 months to rub them down with oil and myrrh, and then 6 months with spices and cosmetics. The young lady would go in, verse 14, in the evening, and in the morning she would return to the second harem. And to put it quite bluntly, she would go in a virgin and come out a concubine. So every night the king would test out one of the young virgins from his harem. And when she came from that harem, she would go back into the second harem. And as a concubine, she would not go in again to the king unless the king had been pleased by her performance the previous evening. And he would summon her by name if he ever wanted to see her again. It is almost impossible to estimate how many women he would have, but evidently he had an ongoing stream from the number one harem, and that would continue to fill the number two harem, unless he delighted in an individual and wanted to see her again. Finally, Esther's turn came, and she was taken to the king, verse 16 says, and he loved her more than all the women, and he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And in verse 18, chapter 2, he gave a great banquet, and the name of it was Esther's banquet for all of the princes. And then the virgins were gathered together the second time, and Mordecai was sitting in the gate, still waiting to find out what's going on inside. She had still not told anybody that she was a Jewess. Well, day by day, month by month, and now almost year by year continues by, and Mordecai is still sitting at the king's gate. He is almost like a permanent fixture, and he has probably sat there for so long that no one pays any attention to him anymore. Well, as he's sitting there, he discovers that 2 of the king's officials that guarded the door for some reason became angry at the king and were going to assassinate King Xerxes as he came out the door. But because he had been sitting at the gate, he overheard the plot to assassinate the king and passed it in to Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. The king investigates and found out that the plot was true and hanged both the men, and as always took place in the court of the Persians, everything was documented and filed away in a very orderly manner. We discovered this before when the king located very quickly the document which had been written 19 years before to validate the decree of Cyrus. Chapter 3 continues by introducing us to Haman, the Agagite. He is a proud man with political aspirations and continues to advance in the kingdom, and did find eventually that he had established authority over all the princes who were with him. This was an up-the-corporate-ladder situation with Haman, and he was evidently a very successful politician. All of the servants at the king's gate used to bow down to Haman as he came into the palace, because the king had commanded everyone to bow down to him. But old Mordecai, who had been sitting there for so long, who now knows that his own cousin is queen of the land, does not bow down to old Haman. Finally, the other servants asked him in verse 3 why he transgressed the king's command, and He told them he was a Jew. He's not going to bow down. When Haman came by and he actually observed that Mordecai was not bowing down to him, he became filled with rage. Even though he was angry because he discovered that Mordecai was a Jew, he was afraid to touch him, but determined to destroy all the Jews so that Mordecai would be one of the ones who met his death. Verse 7 gives us another chronological indication, just as verse 16 in chapter 2 did. Remember that the king met Esther in the 7th year of his reign, which would have been after his defeat at Salamis in 479. And now 5 years after his marriage to Esther, as recorded in verse 7, chapter 3, in the 12th year of the king, they began to cast the lot to see when they would destroy all the Jews, and the lot fell on the month Adar. In other words, Haman cast lots until he could arrive at the strategic month when the attack on the Jews would take place. Then Haman said to the king in verse 8, "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples all around your kingdom, and they have different laws than we have, and they don't observe your laws. King, I don't believe it's in your best interest to let them remain. So, if it is pleasing to you, let it be decreed that they be destroyed. In fact, I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business to put into the king's treasuries." Evidently, Haman is a very wealthy man. So, the king, I think, is not himself. I would think that he's probably devastated psychologically because of the military disasters which have befallen him. And it's almost as if he isn't thinking. He doesn't question this statement by Haman. And he just takes off his signet ring and gives it to Haman and says, "The people are yours. Just go ahead and do with them as you please." All of this is written in the law of the Medes and the Persians, and it's sealed with the king's signet ring. The letters were sent to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, to annihilate the Jews, both young and old, women and children, in one day, and it's to be the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and in addition to destroying all the Jews, they are to take their possessions as plunder or booty. Does that sound familiar? Well, it certainly does, and it is simply reminiscent of everything that has happened to the Jews from the earlier time period in the northern and southern kingdom down to the Holocaust and World War II. Verse 14 says that a copy of the edict was issued as law in every province, and couriers ran throughout the entire land, and while the decree was being issued, the king and Haman sat down to drink. When Mordecai hears about it in chapter 4, he rends his garment, he puts on sackcloth and ashes, and begins to wail loudly throughout the streets of the city. He walked all the way up to the king's gate, but did not go inside, because, again, as we said before, the kings of Persia did not want any wailing or any unhappiness inside the gate. It says here, no one was to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. And mourning went up throughout the land when the Jews and all the provinces heard that they were going to be annihilated in one day. They began to weep and mourn and fast and put on sackcloth and ashes. Finally, Queen Esther's maidens and the eunuchs came and told her, and she was in great anguish. And she sent new garments for Mordecai, but he did not take off his sackcloth. And Esther calls in one of the king's eunuchs, her personal attendant, and ordered him to go to Mordecai and learn exactly what was going on. So this eunuch went out and searched out Mordecai in the city square. He found him in front of the king's gate. Mordecai related to him everything that had taken place and the exact amount of money that Haman had promised to pay the king for the destruction of the Jews. He even took a copy that he had ripped off the wall of the decree and gave it to the eunuch so that he might take it back and show Esther this printed document that had gone throughout the land in hopes that she would go into the king to ask the king to rescind this document. The eunuch relates everything to Esther, and Esther gives him a message to take back to Mordecai. She says, the law of the land is that anyone who goes in to see the king who has not been summoned shall be put to death. The only way that a person will not be put to death is if he holds out the golden scepter. She says, I have not been summoned for 30 days. Xerxes would not allow anyone to come near him. We know from the drawings on the Persian walls, which have been unearthed by archaeologists, that Xerxes would sit on his throne with his scepter at his side. His son Artaxerxes would stand behind him, and in front of King Xerxes would be a censer with burning incense, so that no one could come beyond the burning incense into the presence of Xerxes. This was ultimate power. No one could come into his presence without being slain unless he had been summoned, or if by some reason Xerxes extended the scepter in grace. When Mordecai heard this, he said, Esther, you think you're safe in there. Don't imagine that because you're in the king's palace, you can escape any more than all the other Jews. Because if you stay silent, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from, and at this point we want to say God. But God's name is never mentioned in the book of Esther. And the writer of Esther says, from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this? Who knows, Esther, but what you are in God's plan. And that God has arranged all of these things, knowing in advance what Haman would do, and has placed you in the kingdom so that you can respond and to play the advocate for the Jews and to stand in the breach and to be the one that will save the lives of these thousands of Jews throughout the provinces of Persia. Who knows? But you may just have been brought here for such a time as this. Verse 15, Esther gives the reply to Mordecai. She said, assemble the Jews, fast for me, don't eat or drink for 3 days. I and my maidens will fast in the same way, and then I will go into the king, although he has not summoned me. I will go in, and it's not even according to the law of the Persians. But when I walk in there, if I perish, I perish. And Esther is about to become a heroine. Chapter 5 picks up the narrative. It says that on the third day, that is the third day after the fast had begun, Esther put on her royal robes, she put on her finest outfit, and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, in front of the king's inner sanctum, the king's rooms, and the king was sitting on his royal throne in the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. And I imagine that Esther's palms were sweaty, and she had butterflies in her stomach. And she knew that in the next few seconds, she would either be condemned to die or would be invited into the presence of the mightiest monarch on the face of the earth. Although the name of God is never mentioned in the book of Esther, the Holy Spirit, as the author of this book, has such a marvelous way of presenting things. And we see the sovereign hand of God in all these events. And just as Ruth happened on the field of Boaz, and just as in the next chapter we'll see that the king happened upon the particular record or chronicle which told of the plot of the assassins to kill him and the heroism of Mordecai, now in verse 2 we see, and it happened, when the king saw Esther the queen standing at the court, she obtained favor in his sight. And again we see the heart of the king is in the hand of the Lord. And the king extended to Esther the golden scepter. And Esther came in and touched the top of the scepter. And now the Holy Spirit brings us as eyewitnesses into the inner chambers of the most powerful monarch in the earth, and allows us to hear the conversation that goes on between Haman and Xerxes and Esther. And through this divinely inspired book, we are allowed to stand invisible in the very court of Xerxes and be silent participants in this scenario which will transpire. When Esther touches the top of the scepter, the king says, "What's troubling you, Queen Esther? What's your request? Even to half of the kingdom, I'll give it to you." And Esther said, "I have a banquet planned. If it please the king and Haman, come this day to the banquet I have prepared for him," that is, for Haman. Notice that Esther does not speak out immediately against Haman. If you recall, in the previous chapter 3, we saw that the very last verse said that the king and Haman sat down to drink. They were close friends and political allies. It would have been very bad for Esther had she came in and made an overt accusation against Haman. Esther is wiser than that. And now she plans very subtly to bring about the salvation of her people in a very clever way. And she appeals to the ego of Haman and to her husband, the king, as well, by inviting them to a banquet which she is preparing. Xerxes said, "Bring Haman quickly, so we can do as Esther desired." And the king and Haman came to the banquet. The king loved parties, we know that from chapter 1. As they drank their wine at the banquet, the king said again to Esther, "What's your petition, even to half the kingdom?" Esther gave her answer in verse 8. "If I have found favor," she said, "in your sight, and if it please the king to grant my petition and do what I request, then may the king and Haman come to the banquet which I shall prepare for them again, and tomorrow I will do as the king requests." She has invited them to a second party. Haman went out that day glad and pleased of heart. Haman is just as happy as a lark. He has just banqueted with the queen and the king. He has been invited to another party the next day. But as he walks out by the gate, he looks down and sees Mordecai. And Mordecai just brushes him off. He doesn't stand up. He doesn't tremble before him. And as a result of this, Haman's anger just burns against Mordecai. But he controlled himself, and he went home to his house. He sent for his friends, and he began to brag about himself to all of them. He talked about his invitation to the party, but said he was still unhappy because he had to see Mordecai sitting at the gate each day. His wife and his other friends suggested that he build a gallows 50 cubits high, 75 feet tall, and ask the king to hang Mordecai on the gallows. The saying pleased Haman, and he had the gallows constructed. This is the end of side 1.